Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hear me? Can you hear me on the phone?
I do. I've got you coming out of every orifice.
I'm really not... You're breaking up quite badly.
Hello and welcome to The Lock-In, where I finally get to talk to people I want to hear from in a place I want to be, the pub.
For some reason, this bloody thing has started playing back some rubbish.
Oh, right.
Where were we? I've forgotten.
I have too.
I'm talking today with one of my heroes. You may not know of Elliot Higgins, but he, or rather his organisation Bellingcat, has thrown a great deal of light on things that other people have tried to keep very secret. Things like the Salisbury poisoners, who they really were, and why that Malaysian airliner was actually shot down by the Russians and not, as they claimed, the Ukrainians. He's not a spy. His organisation Bellingcat works off information any of us could get if we tried and knew what to do with it and had his patience. He's rather brilliant. Elliot, can you just tell us what Bellingcat does?
So Bellingcat uses something called open source information, which is basically any information that you can find online, to investigate a whole range of different topics. I launched it in 2014 after blogging for a couple of years, and our first really big story was the downing of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 in eastern Ukraine in July 2014. And that was really the start of a series of investigations on a range of topics that uses open source to really expose wrongdoers and kind of reveal the truth to people.
When you say open source, what do you mean?
So it's really literally anything you can find in the public domain. It can include things like social media posts. It can include YouTube videos, which, you know, was a big source when I was studying Syria. But things like Google Earth satellite imagery has also been extremely useful. And it was really because of two kind of main kind of developments from about 2007 and 2008 onwards that we can do this. One is the development and popularization of smartphone technology. So everyone got apps on social media and was sharing information about themselves all the time. So we kind of investigate that stuff. And at the other side, we had platforms like Google Earth making satellite imagery available, Google Street View and other sources that allowed us to cross-reference that material against the open source social media material we were finding to verify it and confirm details about it.
So anyone could do this if they knew how to do it and they had your patience?
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a laptop, if you've got some patience and you've got a decent internet connection, then you can do exactly the same stuff that we're doing.
So what's special about you?
I mean, there's really nothing special about me. I think maybe it was more a matter of kind of luck and my personal interests in what was happening with the Arab Spring in 2011 when I first started thinking about, you know, this kind of material. But really, I only started because I was frustrated at the way the media were ignoring videos, claims from the ground that they said they couldn't verify. And I thought you could maybe verify this stuff. And I kind of stumbled into this idea of using videos from conflict zones and other sources and using them to understand the conflict after you could verify them using things like satellite imagery. And there were kind of a small group of other people doing that. But I just happened to have the time and, you know, dedication to, you know, stick at it and keep going.
What were you doing at the time?
When I first started, I was working in an admin job as a company that housed refugees on behalf of the government. The company actually lost its contract, and I was kind of the only person kind of left in the office for weeks and weeks, with not too much work to do. So I spent an awful lot of time arguing with people on the Guardian Middle East live blog about what was happening in Libya at the time in early 2011. And it was really from kind of really wanting to win those arguments that I started looking at these videos that everyone was debating. I thought, well, how can I actually, you know, verify where these are being filmed? Because it is a fair point. If people say, well, how do you know where that is filmed? Then you need a good answer to that. And that's kind of really where it all started for me.
Did you always want to be a spy?
No, not at all. I mean, I really didn't have kind of much of an idea of what I wanted to do. And I like the idea of investigating things just as a kind of general thing. You know, I like watching Columbo and that kind of stuff, but it never really was anything I think I could do that as a career. I saw that this was an interesting thing you could do with this kind of information that was now appearing from places like Libya and Egypt and Syria, and just wanted to kind of understand what was happening in those places more. It was just very frustrating when I was kind of finding all this really interesting content that did seem to tell more than the kind of mainstream media was saying about these conflicts, and it was just being completely ignored because they felt it wasn't reliable.
What was the key breakthrough for you?
I think it was that the first moment was doing my first geolocation. So geolocation is where you satellite imagery and other reference imagery to figure out where photograph or video was filmed by looking at the various features and comparing it to what's in the satellite imagery. And when I realized you could do that, that was kind of really the first moment where I thought, oh, this is actually interesting and actually quite fun to do. It's like solving a puzzle that told you more about what was going on. So I started doing that more and more and more, just kind of on online forums and, you know, no blog or anything like that. But I then decided to launch my blog, which I call the Brown Moses blog after a Frank Zappa song that I liked, in early 2012. And that's when the Syria conflict was starting to escalate. I was also writing about the UK phone hacking scandal at that point. But that's really when I started building an audience of people who were curious about what I was doing, and that I was doing this process where I could show the source I was using and explain the method I was using to come to my conclusions. And there were kind of people who were also quite obsessed with these kind of what was happening in these conflicts, you know, journalists, you know, people from NGOs and just ordinary people who started following my work, and it just kind of built and grew from there.
Are they all in the West?
No, I mean, I kind of built a following even among kind of Syrians and, you know, people from all across the world. So, you know, that came in quite handy later on when I started writing about incidents on the ground. And sometimes I would have, you know, those people who were kind of witnesses contacting me and saying, you know, these videos have been posted online. Have you seen them of this incident? And that was certainly true with the August 21st, 2013 sarin attacks, which became one of my first kind of really major stories.
So really anybody could do this if they just had the motivation and the dedication.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's really nothing complicated about what we're doing. It's kind of like learning how to use a variety of tools to solve a problem. And some of it's quite straightforward. If you have a video and you want to know where it was filmed, then it's always really the same process. Check satellite images, look at details in the video that might tell you where it's filmed. You know, if you're lucky, there's like a shop sign with a phone number on it that you can just Google. If you're less lucky, you might find something that's, you know, a large building that's fairly unique, like a mosque or, you know, a very large structure that you can then use satellite imagery of the area to narrow down. But that's not difficult to do. We train a whole range of different people from different backgrounds how to do this work, often with a huge range of technical skills to real beginners to people who've had a lot of experience. So it's really something that can be taught to anyone. And it's very, I mean, I taught this to myself. I didn't know what I was doing. I just kind of stumbled into this and then figured out this was a way you could do things. And this kind of idea of geolocation suddenly became like a core skill of anyone doing this kind of work. And it just grew and grew and grew.
Are you worried now about giving techniques away?
I mean, it's kind of a nature of what we do, because we do want to give these techniques away to as many people as possible. I think for all of us at Bellingcat now, we want to know more about the topics we're interested in. And if that means someone else is doing the reporting and doing great work on it, that's great. if they're using kind of Bellingcat methodologies to do that, that's absolutely fine with us because we're getting kind of the information we're interested in. And we've never had this kind of approach of wanting scoops or, you know, not working with other people. It's been always about collaboration. And the more we've grown, the more ways we have of collaborating with different kinds of organizations that we think has much more impact than just trying to keep stories to ourselves.
As a journalist, you know, that really struck me, that it's the antithesis of journalism. Journalism, you get a scoop, you don't share it with anybody because it's not a scoop then. But in your way, you collaborate.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely core to what we're doing. I mean, early on, when I was just kind of me and my blog and, you know, a few people reading it, I started being contacted by arms experts who were interested in the weapons I was writing about, because that was kind of my initial focus. Then people from human rights organizations who were also interested in those weapons because they could have been cluster bombs or something that kind of violated international law. And I was like saying, why aren't the arms experts and the human rights people talking to each other more? So I would connect people together. And over time, it kind of developed a network around kind of myself and my blog of people from all kinds of different fields. So I think they saw me as being a neutral party. They didn't see me as a journalist or a human rights person or an arms person. They just saw me as someone finding interesting stuff they wanted to know more about. So I was able to connect them. And now when we're doing our work, well, if we have a big story that might have kind of apply more to a local audience, say in Germany or Greece or, you know, somewhere in South America or Africa, we'll work with local news organizations, regional news organizations, along with NGOs who might have a specialization in that area and other organizations who can use analytical techniques, for example, Forensic Architecture, who does a lot of 3D modeling around the kind of work we do, and combine all those efforts. But we all then have this kind of final product that fits our audience. So, you know, the local newspaper or publish their articles, the NGOs will do their reports, we'll do our very detailed analysis, we'll have kind of some forensic analysis. And then when it comes to kind of having impact from that work, which is a big part of why we do our work, it's kind of a multi-pronged attack against the problem, rather than it just coming from one source, it's coming from a whole range of different sources, but it's using the same verified evidence that we've kind of shared in our collaboration.
I mean, you believe what? The truth matters, is that what it is?
I think so. I believe that if you're just writing something for the sake of writing it, then, you know, what's the point? You want to have it actually have an impact. You want to change stuff for the better. You just don't want to put stuff out there just because, you know, it strokes your ego and you can get, you know, 10,000 views on your blog. Because what's the point if there's not any real impact from that? So for me, it's all about seeing if we can actually make a positive change rather than just, you know, spewing out stuff to, you know, readers who might find it interesting, but it has no real impact. I'd rather 10 people who can actually have an impact on the thing we're writing about read a story than a million people who are just ordinary readers.
The thing about our intelligence agencies is that they're accountable to, the people of this country. Who are you accountable to?
Well, I mean, currently, Bellingcat's actually now a foundation in the Netherlands with AMBI status, and we have a supervisory board who, if I do anything terribly wrong, they can fire me. Even though I founded the organization. So, and we actually set that stuff up on purpose because we wanted to put a certain amount of distance between us and other organizations who have kind of said to they've been working for the public good, but have basically just become the personal fiefdoms of kind of individual personalities. I don't want this to kind of be Elliot Higgins on the top and Bellingcat below and then, you know, run it like that. It's all about Bellingcat first. And, you know, I'm part of Bellingcat, not just Bellingcat.
But you are Western, aren't you?
I am, yes. I would say I'm extremely Western.
So you couldn't see this sort of organisation developing in the Eastern Bloc, could you?
Well, I mean, there are some smaller organisations who do similar work as Bellingcat. I just think we're fortunate to be in a position where we can write about things in a country where we're not immediately going to be thrown in prison or harassed or attacked. Because it's upsetting the local authorities. And when you're dealing with countries in the East, and we've done a lot of work on Russia and working with Russian partners, you know, they have to take those risks. And we work with, you know, very brave organizations like The Insider, for example, who often partner with us on stories that involve Russian assassinations of domestic political opponents. And they're taking massive risks to do what they're doing. So But I think because Bellingcat is able to work in these kind of collaborative groups, it kind of gives them, you know, someone outside of the country who can support them and, you know, help them with their investigations and give them that kind of visibility that they wouldn't otherwise have.
Are there any dictators you admire?
No, none at all, I would say. Not a single one.
But your core value is democracy, isn't it? And the democratisation of information.
I would say so. And what we're trying to do is, you know, spread these techniques as wide and far as possible, because we've certainly seen the damage the internet can do, the way it can, you know, cause people to become effectively radicalised around a whole range of subjects, you know, everything from things like QAnon to coronavirus conspiracy theories to denialism around chemical weapons attacks in Syria. You see the same kind of pattern of behaviour on the internet of how people find these kind of groups that don't trust mainstream authority. And rather than being served a kind of evidence-based approach to questioning that, they have a conspiracy-based approach to questioning that. And we kind of are fighting not just against kind of the big guys, but this sense that people are powerless, that they can't do anything in the world. And that's the feeling that drives them towards these kind of more radical groups online.
How do you decide what to investigate?
Well, when we launched Bellingcat, it was basically crowdfunded for about £60,000, which covered my wage and the cost of the website. So it was really down to what the volunteers found interesting. It just happened 3 days after Bellingcat was launched, MH17 was shot down in eastern Ukraine, and that's what everyone was interested in. So all the volunteers I was talking to, you know, and working with were just focused on that one topic. We kind of then developed this kind of informal investigation team that, you know, was about six or seven people. And we kept looking into MH17 because there was so much to find. And it's one of those stories where you have one side who is, you know, lying about what's happening. And those are always the most interesting stories to investigate, I find. And then that led us into more findings about Russia's involvement in eastern Ukraine and the, you know, various military involvement they had there. But that was always like a kind of organic volunteer-led process. But even now, when we're, you're an organization, we have 20 staff members and we have, you know, people investigating a range of topics, it's really led by what the investigators want to look at rather than what I find personally interesting. I'm not like an editor saying you must write about this or that. I'm just like saying, if you're interested in something, have a look, see what there is. And I think we're mostly interested in the same things, you know, stories where there's an element of, you know, accountability needed. And that can be on a whole range of things. I mean, we're probably best known for our Russia investigations, but we've just published a investigation that's into illegal wildlife trade in Dubai, where these animals, these kind of lion cubs and animals like that are being used for Instagram photo shoots. And it's part of actually an illegal wildlife trade, but it's all documented through Instagram because this is how people, you know, are using these animals. And that's very different from, you know, Russian assassinations, but there's still an element of accountability there.
Have you been doing a lot during the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, Bellingcat's expanded a lot in the last 2 years, so I've been mostly focused on how that kind of is developing. But our team has been working on a whole range of topics, and because we're used to being stuck at home on our laptops, that's our natural environment. So it hasn't really changed the way that we work that much. I mean, the only thing it really changed is we were doing a lot of in-person workshops, so they all moved online, fortunately, successfully. But the rest of it, we've just continued to do investigations. I mean, people are spending more and more time online now, so that means more information they're generating about, you know, their lives, which can be useful for our investigations.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Why are you in Leicester?
I just kind of ended up there. It wasn't even like a really conscious choice. My dad was in the RAF, so when I was younger, I was moving around the country quite a bit. And it got to the point about 15 years ago when I arrived in Leicester, you know, for a job, that I thought I did really want to move house that much again, because it's, you know, all that upheaval isn't always great. So I just kind of settled here. And then everyone's always like, why aren't you in London where all the media is? And I don't really need to be. I mean, it can be a bit inconvenient when people want you to come and film something at their studio, but, you know, we're only an hour away on the train in Leicester, so it's not like the other side of the planet.
Is there anyone you wouldn't take money from?
Yeah, I mean, we don't take money directly from governments, for example. There are some projects we're involved with that have like government funding, like the Open Information Partnership, which is about countering kind of Russian disinformation by training journalists and activists in local areas how to do the same kind of investigative techniques we do. We certainly wouldn't take money from a project like that if it was an editorial thing, though. It's only when it's providing training. And if it's from any, you know, individuals who expect us to write about specific topics for the money, then we're not interested in that either. I've actually had quite a lot of people since the book's come out asking if I give you this money, will you investigate this specific topic? And we're like, no, because that's not how we operate as an organisation.
Are you worried about the future? You worried, you know, you may not be able to keep it up?
I think as an organisation, Bellingcat has continued to grow, and we have continued success, and I'm not worried about Bellingcat as an organisation. I am worried about maybe the state of the internet and the way disinformation has continued to spread, and how I think a lot of the people who are thinking they can deal with this problem, the policymakers and governments, are really don't understand the problem they're dealing with. They think this is something they can kind of, you know, ask the social media platforms to fix, and really it's a societal issue. It's about communities who don't trust mainstream sources of authority. You know, they don't trust the media or government, and they find these alternative sources of authority online. And that often brings them in contact with conspiracy theories, and a portion of those people become increasingly radicalized effectively. And that's why we start seeing events like what happened on January 6th in Washington, D.C., with the violence that happened there. But this happens on a whole range of different topics and subjects. And I think because, you know, policymakers don't recognize that this is the issue. They think it's because Facebook is recommending you join certain groups. And that's an element of it, but there's a much deeper issue here that I think we have to kind of look at as a society. And I think we need kind of more radical ideas to solve those issues rather than just leaning back and hoping for the best.
Do you worry about what's happening with our intelligence agencies, that they're being beaten by amateurs?
The thing is, for all I know, the intelligence agencies knew all about this stuff and just didn't tell the public about it, which, you know, is a bit concerning considering what we've been finding. But when we start moving into areas like the Russian assassinations, for example, I think we've published on 7 Russian assassinations that appear to have used nerve agents. And we probably have 4 or 5 at least we'll be publishing about in the following weeks. And I expect we'll find even more. And the reaction of the world so far has been to discuss sanctions. And until Russia is paying a price that it doesn't want to pay, and dispelling diplomats is a price they're happy to pay, they're going to keep on doing this. This is a price that is factored into how they operate. And I think that should worry a lot of people, because if we've exposed these assassinations of Russian political figures, of, you know, quite minor activists, and as we'll show later on with our future investigations, it's a whole range of Russian society who've been targeted by this FSB assassination team. This world doesn't do anything about it apart from the usual dispelling of diplomats and a few sanctions here and there that have no real impact. Why would Russia stop doing it? It would seem like a green light to go ahead and keep killing people, because there's no real consequences for them, even when it's been completely revealed to the public and to the governments of the world.
So the Salisbury poisonings, which we all know about, the Skripals, the poor people who were poisoned there by the Russians, they were not the beginning of the process.
No, I mean, it seems to be, I mean, after the 2018 Skripal poisoning, we investigated who the suspects were and find they were serving GRU officers. We found details of a third suspect and we managed to get his phone records. That showed he had been travelling to Bulgaria in the previous years, and there he had been following a guy called Emilian Gebrev in 2015, who was a Bulgarian arms dealer who was mysteriously poisoned in 2015. We looked into that, and there was an entire GRU operations team who'd been following him about, and they'd been in contact with a laboratory in Russia where all the scientists from the former Novichok program that was supposedly shut down by Russia as part of the Chemical Weapons Convention had moved. And they supposedly were manufacturing sports nutrition, but it seems like they're actually manufacturing Novichok to give to these assassination teams. And when Navalny was poisoned, we looked into these same people and we got their...
This is the dissident who in Russia currently alive.
That's correct. And so when Navalny was poisoned in August 2020, we looked into this lab again and we got their phone records. And it just happened at the same time Navalny was poisoned, they'd been in contact with an FSB team who we also investigated. We got their travel records and phone records and other information. And they had followed Navalny on 40 trips, including the one where he was poisoned. Then we looked into more of those trips and discovered there were more individuals who had been followed by them multiple times and then fallen mysteriously ill, either dying or often falling into comas. So this whole program seems to, the more we dig into it, the more it seems to expand and the wider range of targets it's going after.
But how on earth do you get the flight records and phone records of people who are working for top secret government installations in Russia?
Well, Russia is accidentally one of the most open societies in the world because it is endemically corrupt from top to bottom. And you have a very healthy market for data. This has been going on for years. I mean, I read a Financial Times article from 12 years ago recently that talked about car boot sales in Russia selling CDs with government databases on them. So this information has been out there and available for a long time. And also, aside from these leaked databases, you're also able to find people on the internet forums who know people who can buy, you know, acquire certain data. And it can be phone records, it can be travel records. I've seen a journalist recently buy all her sightings on Russia's facial recognition system on their Moscow CCTV cameras. It's everything, and it's basically freely available to anyone who wants to do it. You can join like a Telegram channel that sells information, and you just have to type in the number of the person you're looking for and it sends you all their details. It's as easy as, you know, any other of the sources we use, really. And because of that kind of endemic kind of leaking of data and, you know, selling of data, you're able to, you know, just go out and find it and buy it. And we explained how you did this with our investigation, because usually we're using open source material. So this is stuff that's publicly available, and this is kind of different. This is stuff you have to find and buy, even though it's quite easy to do. So we explained how we did it in our investigations on Navalny, and other Russian media outlets went out and actually purchased the same data and checked it against what we had claimed. And they were saying, yeah, this is actually, you know, legitimate data. Because, of course, the Russian government immediately started saying that we were working for the British, you know, spy services or MI5 or MI6 or CIA or, you know, whichever three-letter agency was in their head. So we had to be very transparent about this process of how we got this data, and that allowed it to be verified by other media organisations.
But once money enters into the equation, things become contaminated and untrustworthy, don't they?
Well, not in the case of this, because it's not like when we're going to these people, we're saying, oh, hey, can you get me this FSB officer's flight records? It's like, can you, we've got a passport number, can you get the passport, you know, the travel details for this person? Or we say, we've got this phone number, can you send us like 2 years of phone records? And they don't know what we're looking for. And we're also using multiple sources as well. So we aren't just, if we have a data point we're going to use, we'll have usually like three sources that confirm that individual data point. Like we'll buy one set of phone records from someone, find the person they're calling, buy that person's set of phone records from somewhere else, and then compare them and make sure they actually match and there's no differences. So by having this kind of triangulation of those different sources, and because there's so many people who are kind of providing this information and all these previously leaked databases, you can actually have multiple sources to verify this kind of stuff.
What's your dream?
My dream?
What in your ideal world, how would it be?
I mean, it'd be nice to have a world where we could go outside, but apart from that, I would really like there to be a lot of organisations like Bellingcat using our kind of methodologies, part of a network as well, working on a whole range of topics, and not one that's centralised around Bellingcat, you know, a decentralised network where we can kind of propagate ideas, work together on investigations, people can team up, collaborate with media organisations, NGOs, even policymakers to actually have a positive impact on topics that we actually all care about. And I think the problem with the internet is often it's very easy just to get really angry at someone because they don't agree with every single thing you think and say. And I think we need to start thinking what we actually have in common, what we actually all care about. And I know there's still going to be people who disagree with each other, but if we're just screaming at each other, then I don't think we're really going to achieve much.
You said there it would be nice to go out. Is this the traditional sandal-wearing screen addict, or is it something more serious?
Well, I mean, it's part of the problem I have now is obviously, you know, when you start writing about Russian assassinations and revealing their secret nerve agent programs, people start getting worried. I mean, I've been contacted by British counterterrorism police about my personal safety because of what we've been writing. Our lead investigator, Christo Groves, he's, you know, constantly being contacted by the police about his safety. And I'd like to, you know, I'd like to be able to go to a hotel and actually feel that I am safe enough to order food on room service without it having nerve agent in it. Which might seem a bit silly, but considering, you know, the amount of nerve agent poisonings we've discovered at both inside Russia and outside of Russia, it does make you a lot more cautious about your own personal safety.
I'm amazed that you're as open as you are. The Russians are really bad people, or the regime is a bad entity, as far as someone like you is concerned.
Well, for us, if we're kind of hiding in the shadows, we think that actually, in a sense, makes us more easier targets, because if some person you've never heard of dies, then you're not going to care. But, you know, you don't know who they are and you won't think that the Russians are involved. If I stub my toe, people will think the Russians are involved at this point. So by keeping our profile as high as possible and making as much noise as possible, we hope that's some form of protection. Maybe we're naive and wrong, and maybe Russia is that crazy that they would do something like that. But the alternative is trying kind of hide away. And the way we work, being so open, using evidence like the way we do, being transparent about our processes, it just isn't really compatible with kind of hiding our identities. And I mean, we still have to be careful about our security. We aren't like posting our passwords online or anything like that, but we have to be very public figures, we think, because having that profile acts as a certain level of kind of protection. Plus, these are really important issues. You know, Russia is using a secret nerve agent program in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention to assassinate people, both at home and abroad. And that's just the ones using nerve agents. I mean, we've investigated stuff where they've just used guns, you know, normal assassinations to kill people. So this is happening a lot. And we're, I think, often fairly uniquely placed to actually report about this. So, I mean, sometimes people say, well, is it okay to buy information? You know, ethical considerations around that. And, you know, we have these discussions, but we know we can do it, and we know by writing about it there's a good chance that more assassinations will stop. So we have to be out there, we have to, like, really, you know, push these stories and make a noise about them, otherwise people will die.
And that's your whole shtick, really, isn't it? Hiding in plain sight is consonant with how you operate and what you believe in.
I think so, in a sense. I mean, in a way, all the information we find, yes, hiding in plain sight. I mean, when we were looking into, you know, the downing of MH17, all the information we found was out there. It was on the internet from the day it happened because people were posting about it. We just had to discover it. When Russian soldiers were going from Russia to Ukraine, you know, they're posting about it on their social media profiles, but you had to look and find it. But it's all there. All this information is there. It's not hidden away behind passwords and, you know, locked files and mysterious websites. It's on Google Earth. You can do a Google search and find, you know, where kind of, well, not quite Russian spies, but you can find a huge amount of information about subjects you're looking into. You just have to dig and dig and dig.
Well, good luck to you. I admire you.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, there you are. Elliot Higgins, a slightly unlikely super sleuth for the internet era. Should be very interesting to see what he can turn up in years to come. Next week, we've got Rowan Hooper of The New Scientist, who's written a book about how you could best spend $1 trillion if you wanted to have a positive impact on the world. Tune in for that if you're into big ideas. He's got plenty. In the meantime, I'm going to keep dreaming of the pub.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.